This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, Dee. How's it going?
Hey, Devin. Pretty well. How are you?
Not bad. How's the climate out there in Mississippi?
Oh, well, Mississippi is all about climate. That's that's what we have. We have lots of climate, I guess, at least in the popular imagination.
Together.
Yeah, we've got all the climates. Yeah, exactly.
We've got rain coming in here this week, and usually it catches me off guard. It's like LA Story when Steve Martin pre-records to get ready for his big date. So he just throws up like all the sun, and then it's a big storming, rainy thing. But this time I'm well prepared. Be ready to
That's good. Yeah. I was going to say, I mean, honestly, California has really the real claim to all the climates. Honestly, you guys are going crazy out there trying to the forefront and the avant-garde as usual.
Yeah. We've got all the four horsemen of the climate apocalypse, you know,
mm-hmm.
Fire.
Yeah.
We've even got hurricanes now. It's an exciting place to live.
Yeah, I bet.
Well, maybe you can introduce yourself. I'll introduce myself and we'll get to talking about our guest here.
Awesome. Sounds great. So I'm Deanna Kreisel. I'm an associate professor of English at the University of Mississippi, where I'm also the co-director of the Environmental Studies program, which as of right now offers only a minor, but we are in the process of turning into a major, which is very exciting. So yeah,
exciting.
That's me. Yeah.
That's awesome. I'm Devin Griffiths. I'm at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles, and I'm kind of beaming to you from the Environmental Humanities Working Group at the Levin Institute for the Humanities. So I'm really excited about this podcast. First time I've ever posted one, because you are an amazing podcaster in your own right. You've got this great podcast called Dr. Waffle and Friends with Tanya Israel. And then our guest today is also an amazing podcaster. His podcast, Cultures of Energy, which he does with Simi Howe, is a must listen. I listen to it all the time. So I'm excited to introduce Dominic Boyer. Dominic is a professor of anthropology at Rice University, and he has so many hats, it's kind of hard to figure out which ones to list. But of many of them, that includes he's a co-director of the Center for Coastal Futures and Adaptive Resilience. He's on the board of governors for the Sustainability Institute at Rice, and he's on the executive board of the American Anthropological Association. And he's also one of the main organizers for Petrocultures this year, which we'll be hosting at USC coming up in May. But he's here today because he's the author of No More Fossils from Minnesota's excellent Forerunner series, mm-hmm. a really awesome book. And so I thought it'd be great to have him on the New Books Network and talk about it a little bit. So welcome, Dominic.
Hey, thank you both so much for the invitation. It's a great honor to be with you. And I want to try putting my video back on for a bit just because it's more fun that way.
Yeah.
Yes, we're all looking at each other now, including my conference clothes in my closet. So that's
That is called a podcast studio in my experience. That's also where we recorded.
Yeah. I've just got my mic like blanketed in a bunch of different blankets and coats and stuff to see if that would work.
We're all learning. All us new podcasters, we're all learning as we go. So
yeah, it's exciting. So I think Dee and I talked a little bit about how we'd like to start, and we were wondering if you might just kind of summarize kind of where the book came from and what you see as the main kind of argument you wanted to get across?
Sure. Well, the book came from a couple of different places. I would say, first of all, it was just a genuine out of the blue curiosity to think a little bit more about fossils, because I don't know how many times I've written about fossil fuels, and the whole time I've been thinking about fuels and not really about fossils. And going down that rabbit hole into learning a bit more about the history and the Earth system processes that are involved with making fossils got me interested in the science and the history of this. It turns out fossils open a lot of doors if you go down that rabbit hole. And I also, you know, share anecdotes about my youth, you know, in the Midwest and going to like Michigan and looking for fossils in the surf. And so it's something to me that's really has been a through line my whole life. But now, of course, we're in a time when fossil fuels have this distinctly, you know, negative association for those of us who care about climate change and climate action. But I have to say that in some ways that aspect of the project was a bit liberating, because I realized that fossils are quite precarious. Like, creating fossils is difficult, sustaining fossils is difficult. And then when we begin to think about the ways in which our society has been fossilized by the logics of fossil fuels, both coal and oil, and I also talk about the plantation logics of the Caribbean and the New World, and how they contributed a chapter to this story too, of making modern capitalism and commodity usage, you begin to think that actually, you know, fossils are kind of miraculous in a certain way when they persist, and it's actually much easier to unmake them than you would think. So it kind of, for me, became a metaphor of thinking about what's politically possible in this moment too. So that's really where it began. I mean, there's more niche-y sort of theoretical things I could get into too, but I think probably that's good enough to start with.
Wonderful. Great. Thank you so much. That's a really helpful overview. I have a couple questions, but before I even dive into the questions, I just want to say that in listening to your description, it just reminded me of one of the many things I admired about this book was it's so economical. Sorry to a weird metaphor, but it really, you give us like an extraordinarily condensed but really well done history of, as you say, sucre politics, carbo politics, petro politics, in a very short space. And it's just really elegantly done. And that's one of the great pleasures of reading it. So, yeah. So I guess my first question, we're going to kind of start with some meta questions, I guess, about the book itself in terms of how you see it positioned, the writing process, et cetera, and then start with some more questions that dive into the aspects of the argument itself. So my first kind of meta question is about the memoir structure, right? Like you just mentioned that you start with some personal anecdotes and you do write in the first person, especially about your childhood encounter with fossils and how that led to this kind of long-standing passion, as you just said. I'm wondering to what extent you thought about doing that deliberately, or was it, I mean, I guess there's a couple prongs to this question. One, it does seem like more and more critical history scholarship, et cetera, is using first person, using memoir, using personal voice. At the same time, as we've seen, there's also been a little bit of a backlash against it too, right? Or at least against certain aspects of, say, auto theory. We're thinking of like Anna Kornblue's recent book, Immediacy. So just wondering like what you thought about that decision to use the first person, to use that kind of personal memoir, and maybe just if that's an opportunity for you to reflect on the writing process more broadly, or how you sort of conceived of the shape and structure of the book as a book.
Thanks, Deanna. That's a great question, and one that I haven't received before, but it's right on target, and I'll tell you why.
Great.
I've spent a lot of time recently, both Simone and I have spent a lot of time recently thinking about ways in which we can translate our academic work to find larger audiences, frankly. And sometimes that's taken the form of creating documentary films or glacier memorials. And sometimes it's been about trying to learn how to write in a way that can kind of meet the world halfway, if that makes sense. Yeah. And if you look at the two dominant genres of nonfiction publishing, at least in the United States, they are memoir and they are self-help. And I think in a way, I envision this little book as being a little bit of memoir and a little bit of self-help, as well as the academic material there. I'm trying very hard as you said, to tell a very big and complex story economically. So to really lean on storytelling a little bit. And I think it's only fair if you're going to lean on storytelling to try to put a little bit of yourself and your personal stakes in. And so the two memoir moments are the opening, the relationship to fossils, and then the time I saw energy transition actually happen. You know, the thing that we all want to happen, and the story of discovering when I moved into the house that I spent most of my youth growing up in on the south side of Chicago, discovering the miracle of this ancient coal furnace. And its last load of coal still sitting there with its coal shovel next to it, as though, you know, one day the people, the coal stokers, had just up and left. And then the transition was on us. And I kind of, again, took a little inspiration from that, from that, and from the work of my friend Alexei Yurchak, who works on the end of the Soviet Union and what it was like to be a member of the last Soviet generation. And one of the things he says is that it was impossible to imagine the end of Soviet socialism until it happened. And when it happened, everyone said, yeah, of course, you know, of course it had to go. But up until that moment, everyone was like, this is going to go on forever. There's no way this will ever change. And I kind of feel like we're in that same space with fossil fuels. We're in a moment where none of us believe that we can really transition. But when the transition comes, I really think we're going to look back on it and say, oh, yeah, of course, you know, of course we had to move away from this energy system. And we're in this really interesting moment right now of that sort of suspended animation, where a system has really lost its purpose, but is sort of continuing on its inertia. And the forces are mobilizing to change right now. But when they come, I still think there's going to be a lot of empty coal carts and coal shovels propped against walls, right? Except whatever the equivalent oil metaphor is for that.
I love that image so, so much. It reminded me of, you know, those photographs maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago of those buildings in Detroit, right, where there's this kind of sense of like these beautiful old hotels. And I think in one case, it was like a dentist's office. And it's like, you know, it's like the rapture, you know, like things like pencils left on desks. And you wonder, like, there was like one day when everything was normal and then no one ever came to that building again. And what was that exact moment? So I just love that image of the coal furnace a lot. Anyway, lots more to say about that, but I'll hand it over to Devin because I know he's anxious to ask some follow-up questions too.
Yeah, I mean, just to get back to that sort of opening anecdote and on the, you know, the shoreline in Michigan. So Dee and I and some other folks are gonna go on a retreat to this ecological field station right near there, I think. And about 30 miles from there is the Indiana Dunes, which you mentioned at the very close. And I think I read in that kind of acknowledgement too of just sort of the history of that region and the history of ecology and Henry Chandler Cowell's work and sort of succession ecology. And I was wondering if alongside the kind of investment in the personal and the sort of communicative dimension of that first person in a memoir experiment, if there's a dimension of it that's also about rooting yourself in place in terms of the writing and kind of thinking about how being placed in those environments attunes people in a different way. Both the ecological crisis and also sort of this layering of histories and futures that you're talking about, like in the coal scuttle.
Absolutely. I think rootedness in place seems to be one of the things that is becoming a bigger conversation in the human sciences, humanities, social sciences right now. I'm thinking of, you know, Anna Singh's work, Donna Haraway's work. Also a lot of work that's inspired by indigenous philosophy, where, you know, thinking through kin and thinking through place is much more important than, you know, the kind of questions that the Western or European tradition has really elevated, like, you know, who am I and like, what should I do with my life? You know, so I think that there's, as we're looking for alternative modes of being human, which I think is a big theme in the world of transitional politics right now, I think that we're looking towards place as one of emplacement or being emplaced as being is something that we can build upon, something that we can work with, and that may offer us some different perspectives on the world. And another reason why that's important that I discovered in the course of researching the book, I really. You know, these questions about why, you know, why does coal become so important at the moment that it does? Why does oil become so important at the moment that it does? These big sort of centuries, sort of epochal shifts, centuries-long epochal shifts between different dominant fuel regimes. are something I think we still need to understand better. Because if we want to understand what gets us out of where we are today, understanding how we transitioned in the past could be helpful. And one of the things I really had underestimated until I really began to do the work on it was thinking about oil and mobility. Automobility, obviously, cars, but also eventually airplanes and container ships and all other sorts of things that run on oil. And how much of the driver of the reorganization of the global economy or from coal, because it was already integrated on a coal economy, but the coal from oil really was a lot about the affordances that oil offered to projects of mobilization. So in a way, I think of petroleum and mobility as something we always should be talking about together. I also have a little section on plastics, which we can come back to later too, if you're interested. But that mobility question means that I think if we're thinking about where to focus our critical attention, where we want to experiment with alternatives to the status quo, mobility seems like an area that's really ripe. And so, you know, obviously, in a certain sense, the antithesis of mobility is staying where you are, right? And so what does it mean to stay where we are? Just define, because stay with the trouble, as Haraway says, in the places where we are. And so, yeah, I think you're right. And this is a very long-winded answer to your question. Sorry, Devin. But yes, yes, finding your place in the world and reckoning with it is definitely something that I've tried to do in this project a little bit.
Yeah, I think it really works. I mean, I'm going to actually twerk this line of questioning in a maybe surprising dimension towards metaphor, because one of the things I really admire about the way the book unfolds is kind of the metaphorics that you use. I mean, there's actual places, but there's a way in which the language you use kind of places the reader and helps them kind of think imaginatively, kind of proprioceptively almost about the experience and sort of there's kind of a physical cognition going on almost. And there's a lot of language of like gunk, you know, and stuff and sort of the feet in the beach, you know, and it's really easy to kind of visualize it. You have this great bit about talking about how to escape from quicksand as kind of a way to imagine this sort of revolution that you're proposing and that it's kind of incremental rather than a thunderclap. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the language decisions you're making too, about how you describe and activate the imagination through this vocabulary, and then how you orient that towards a kind of praxis, a sort of towards transition and getting out.
I think I use the word muck a lot. I use sludge and ooze. Yeah.
It's a very
yeah.
easy there's a, book.
there's a whole set of metaphors. But what I wanted to capture with that is, you know, is to reckon with the reality of the sense of panic that we have. I mean, we talk about climate anxiety, but sometimes I think panic is probably a better way of talking about it. As people become aware of what the problems are and the stakes of inaction or of just continuing along the courses of action we've already laid out, I think people can get very overwhelmed and very panicky. And I totally it is in some ways a rational response. But it also, and I talk about this a little bit at the end, it's also a kind of a manic response in this. But what I mean by mania is a sense of a real, like an affective, emotional overinvestment in what's happening right now. And when I was younger, I had a lot of panic attacks. So it's something that I know quite well from my own sort of physiology and history, that there's a sense of like, you can't really think outside the moment, of just an overwhelming sense of fear about what's happening at that time. And the way you work yourself out of that, obviously, is not to indulge it, but rather to try to kind of displace yourself out of that space of mania. And I think for all of us who very sincerely feel a sense of panic, I think we need to breathe. You know, we need to do our breathing exercises a little bit and realize, okay, this is not the end of something we're experiencing. It's the beginning of something we're experiencing. And it's the beginning of what's going to be a very, very long journey. My friend Tim Morton and I, the English professor turned eco-philosopher.
We're familiar.
We wrote a little crazy book together called Hyposubjects. And in the opening of that, we talk about it, you know, we analogize it to one of the best, I think, kind of climate analogy films that's out there, which is Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity, right? It's about like a really long, hard, arduous process of voyaging back to Earth again, and with all of the sort of levels that implies. And I really think that that's, a better way to orient ourselves. And so the metaphor of muck, the metaphor of being stuck, understanding that the escape from a quicksand is actually slow and deliberate is the best way to go. Don't panic, don't thrash. Little motions, right? Little motions with a clear direction in mind are what gets you out of that. And I think that when everything seems so overwhelming, I think that kind of ethos or that sense of praxis is something that if we could all train ourselves to do that, and I think we are already, there's no great insight here. I think we're all of us who are working on this are doing the little things we can do, right? Our students are doing the little things we can do. Our colleagues are doing the little things we can do. But as we continue to work on that project, I think we're going to find over time that by doing the work, by committing to like that slow process of escape, we're going to feel less panicky and overwhelmed in the now, if that makes sense.
Oh, it makes total sense. And as somebody who, I'm sure I'm not alone in this, just recently realized how much of my behavior is sort of organized by anxiety, I did find it pretty pretty comforting. So I'll pass it over to you.
I was going to say, as a long time, many, many decades from childhood panic attack sufferer, I completely sympathize. And I appreciate the metaphor. I also have thought about this
Can we make another like escape from panic podcast? Yes. Then we can all do that together next
Absolutely.
Year.
I am so boring on this topic because I've been dealing with panic attacks and anxiety for years. I have so many strategies and I will just bend your ear off. But anyway, I do think about this a lot, about how I kind of feel like, you know, when I was 16 and had my first panic attack, I was a freak. And now like everyone, it's like anxiety is the, you know, the mental health problem du jour. And I think a lot of that has to do exactly with climate anxiety and other kinds of anxieties as well. But it's just much more common now. And so I really appreciate that your use of that, the quicksand metaphor. I love that section. And I also really like the, you know, the part at the end when you're sort of addressing the reader directly, like here's a few small, simple things you can do in, you know, in the service of that quicksand metaphor. Like here's some small steps we can take it to move slowly through the ooze. But I had actually a question that was, it's sort of tangential, but it struck me, you know, a lot of like in the latter section of the book, when you're talking about these, you know, what can we do? How can we make incremental changes? How can we sort of basically reorient ourselves to place? And I think you quote, I forget who you're quoting, this kind of, I think it was an Icelandic philosopher about, you know, we should be thinking of this as fun. Like we're going to have like life, if all works out the way we want, life in the future will be, have more sleep and less work and more connection and more, you know, emplacement, et cetera. So one of the things that it did not appear in your book, which I'm always thinking about, is the internet. Because it's, you know, it's such a tricky, obviously we're all thinking now about the ways in which the internet itself, you know, the way that we're conceptualizing it is also unsustainable. It's economically unsustainable. It actually requires, you know, resources that we cannot continue to mine in the same ways. And that's, you know, it's not, the cloud doesn't actually not take any, you know what I mean? So we're all familiar with this arguments, but it's also, the internet is also really part of this, the kind of petro, now I forget which one I would put it in, but the three petro habit and petro, the things that you're talking about at the end, it's part of a kind of mental structure that we use to think our way out of environmental problems sometimes. Like, for example, I'll just zoom into a conference instead of flying to the conference. Or if I find myself in a, you know, if I'm thinking about emplacement, I can be emplaced, but also still be connected to other people in a way. So I feel like a lot of the deep unconscious structure of the ways that we think about environmental problems and solutions now are reliant on assuming that the internet is going to continue in the same way that it does now. In fact, I feel a little panicky at the thought of us all in the future being on our wonderful little matriarchal hunter-gatherer commune units, which is, you know, my vision of the future. But we can't talk to the other ones because there's no internet and we're going to be like, you know. So I just wondered if you could reflect a little bit on where you think that fits into this vision, because it doesn't really appear in your book at all.
It was really interesting. What a blank spot to have. I mean, honestly, I hadn't thought about it until you're just talking about it. Maybe it's because the last little book I wrote was about digital media and digital culture, and so it had more about the internet. For me, it kind of got backgrounded a bit here. But it's obviously very relevant to thinking both about what people are proposing as solutions, as you say, you know, things that we can move to the web so we don't have to move things through physical space and we save energy that way, except that we're also doing all this data mining and cryptocurrency and, like, you know, sort of burning huge amounts of coal in some countries in order to do that. So, you know, it's not easy, but I feel that, you know, I feel like most technology, the internet has its good and bad side. It's got its uses for the future and the things that we have to drop. And I think that idea of having a way of communication and connection across place and time, a sense of immediacy that maybe doesn't replace in-person immediacy, but can be a supplement to it. I like that. Like, I like being able to have this experience with you. I like being able to stay in touch with friends across the world by email. There are those little things that this network enables that I think are great. But I also think that, you know, as with so much of technology, the technophilia, which is really core to our kind of roots in European liberalism, the idea that technology is what drives progress, it's what creates more and better property that we can own and deploy, that aspect of it, which is really obviously in our society the dominant aspect of it, you know, internet is culture making, is something that we should be cautious with and probably could unwind ourselves from without having to lose a lot. So one thing I do with my students, I don't know if this is interesting for y'all to think with me about too. Simony and I have another project called Low Carbon Pleasure and about thinking about ways we can find, like, do inventories of what actually makes us happy and then think about, you know, what are the aspects, what is in that matrix of happiness, are things that we could hold on to without ruining the world. And usually when we break it down and people think about the time with family and friends, you know, going out, having laughs, seeing a comedy show, walking your dog, petting your cat, having a good meal, safe, consensual sex, see, all these things are not the ruin of the world, even if you indulge in them a little bit, right? And I think a lot of what I'm calling petro thrills here in the book are things that have kind of been set out for us as though they should be a still higher level of pleasure. Taking a jet plane to the Caribbean so you can sit in the sun. You know, there's sun most places in the world you could find too, right? So, I mean, the idea that you're going to have this precious, magical, commodified experience that we know they've been selling to us, the titans of transportation have been selling this to us for decades, if not centuries. You know, I think that aspect of it we could get rid of without actually losing a lot. So when we talk about transition, and we don't always have to talk about austerity, I think we could talk about indulgence and happiness too. And I feel like in the internet space, like a lot of, there are some small pleasures. Like, I don't mind watching a 30-second TikTok video. They've given me some laughs. I mean, I can't, I have to be honest, there's some things that are nice about that. But I also know that, you know, if it were to go away, and I don't know if you guys watch this TV series called Station 11. Did you ever
watch it? Yes. Okay. Oh, that's totally what I'm thinking about in the back of my mind, is that kind
what
of,
what a brilliant show. I mean, again, if you have to watch one drama that I know it's about a pandemic, but could stand in as like a climate drama, like a climate apocalypse drama, if you only have to watch one, watch that show, because that show does a better job of painting a realistic future where there is happiness and also dystopia coexisting at the same time. And there's that moment where the internet goes down that I keep thinking of. And for a moment, they're like, we have to download everything. We have to keep all our knowledge. And then it disappears and everyone's like, all right, well, we'll just gotta keep on going. But we're just doing what we humans have always done, which is adapting and relating and, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm a Gen Xer, and I think, you know, you talk in the book about generations, and I should, again, hand it over to Devin, because I have like 80,000 more questions for you. But that whole bit about generations, which I think is so fascinating, I think about and write about actually a lot. There's this wonderful moment in Station 11 where one of the pre-pandies, right, the youngsters who was born after the pandemic, she's holding her phone and she's kind of showing it at the main character. And she's like, explain to me again how this worked. Like, the map was in here.
Why were you guys so upset? Why did you hold these things and walk around all the time? You know, what was wrong with you?
And then I think she said something like, it was all in there. Everything was in there. And it's this kind of chilling moment. But anyway, I'll turn it over to Devin for.
No, I love that scene. I was also in reading this book, I was thinking of Kim Stanley Robinson's Pacific Edge.
Yeah.
Because that's another
Yes, that was on my list of things to bring up. Absolutely, yes. Thank you.
Do you know that? Do you know that KSR story? No, it's not KSR. I'm talking about the other guy. Minority Report.
Philip K. Dick.
Philip K. Dick.
Yes.
There's a story he goes, which is called something like Perky Pat, the something of Perky Pat. It's an old story of his, but it's basically about these people living in a bomb shelter, and the parents are like clinging. They've got a little game they play, which recreates 1950s, 1960s American life, and they're obsessed with playing this game. And their kids are out like hunting, you know, in the valleys, and just kept no. So that sense of like generational displacement when you go through this, and if you grow up in a new situation, humans are so adaptable. Like at that part. Doesn't worry me, you know, as much as, you know, the fact that we may be creating conditions that will make the life opportunities of so many people so much more difficult in the future. There will be a future that has happiness as well as, you know, unhappiness too.
Mm-hmm. But maybe no internet. To get back to,
I'm fine with that in some ways. I mean,
yeah, eventually we'd adapt, right?
Yeah,
we'd
bake eventually
a little more again. Right. But I actually think the internet example is a really nice way to think back to, or kind of get back to the sort of different cultures that you talked about in the book, because mm-hmm. what we're sort of talking around is how there was a moment in which the internet felt like this very green technology, but now there's a deep awareness of how sort of this movement into what feels like an incipient electro culture or solar culture also has a ton of like coal-fired power plants and lithium mining behind it. I mean, that's there are these massive interlocking systems. And one of the things that I really like about the book a lot, thinking about it from the perspective of sort of the energy humanities conversation, is how even when it focuses on one of the material elements of one of these cultural systems, it talks about it as an interlocking set of systems rather than sort of an essential one. So you've talked about sort of sucroculture around the sort of sugar plantation systems of San Domingue, the Barbados. You talk about like carboculture around like coal and steam powered industrialization, petroculture around oil extraction. And I feel like there was a moment a while back where, you know, Patricia Yeager had that kind of famous op-ed in the PMLA that was talking about like whale oil culture and tallow culture, coal culture. There was this idea that like the culture was rooted in a single material, right? And you go way out of your way to point out, no, sucroculture is the interlocking between, you know, sugar harvesting, but also processing, machinery, and eventually steam, right? And so it's the intersection of all these things that constitute sucroculture. And you do the same thing for carboculture and petroculture, that they're never reducible to just one single substance, right? It's the way a bunch of different things intersect in this system of relations. So I appreciated it. I was wondering, could you say just a little more about that turn towards the kind of relational interlocking way of looking at cultures, but also the technologies that sort of sustain them in their imaginaries.
Yeah, and also the kind of the energy sources at the core of it. And there might be people who don't want to think about sugar, coal, and oil as being kind of equivalent in terms of the energy sources. But I think if you think about sugar as a really important, crucial form of biological mm-hmm. energy, right? It makes sense. And I mean, they're still with us today. The idea is not that this is, you know, and then we enter the era of coal and everything was left behind. They kind of like media. One of the things I learned from working on media is it's hard to kill media. They tend to just stack mm-hmm. on top of each other. I mean, you can, but it's sort of like the record player today. What ends up happening, it takes more of a niche role in the background and then something else becomes the dominant form, but doesn't really disappear. And in that way, I think maybe that's not the best metaphor. Maybe sediments is a better metaphor for this, because I think a lot of our society today is still built upon those sucrocultural logics. You know, the idea of more is better, the idea of the pursuit of the sort of instantaneous high, the willingness to commit lots of institutionalized violence in order to get humans and non-humans to produce commodities. I mean, a lot of that mm-hmm. still is part of the world today, even though the steam-powered machinery and, you know, all of the affordances that allowed in terms of productivity really did radically transform our lived experience. I mean, useful things went from being extremely hard to acquire for most people to being abundant. And suddenly you had to think about waste for the first time. You know, what do we do with all this stuff, with the garbage that's left over and so on? So I tend to think of them as being kind of contained, you know, out of each each successive regime absorbs the logics of its predecessors, but also innovates and experiments with the world. So, you know, where we are today is in the throes of a dying petroculture and an uncertain but rapidly gaining strength electric culture. And, you know, I think that we want to fight petroculture. I think that's really important, but we also have to make sure that we don't, you know, we don't take our eye off the electroculture that's forming to make sure that it doesn't repeat a lot of the extractivism and the sort of commodity focus and the capital obsessions that the previous regimes and the mobility sort of without conscience and that the previous regimes have bequeathed to us. So it's a really interesting moment. And I think because we're so concerned with negating what we've inherited, we're not always as mindful, and I say we in a very general sense, we as a society, mindful about making sure that what's coming is really new in substantial ways. And I spent a lot of time studying the politics of renewable energy, and I've learned that you can make wind parks in a terrible, terrible way that do nothing to address the underlying reasons why you need to build a wind park in the first place. You can build them as totally predatory, capitalist, privatizing enterprises, or you can make amazing community wind parks where you share the proceeds back with people, and it does really help the cause of mutual thriving and upward mobility and prosperity. There are different ways. And again, the technologies themselves don't guarantee anything. It's all about what we do and the institutions we build around them. So yeah, it's all relational, Devin, you're right. I mean, at the root of it, it's all relational. And I'm trying to think past the endless debate between sort of idealist and materialist thinking within, again, part of our philosophical heritage, towards trying to think about the space of energy as a relational and also infrastructural space. I mean, I think about infrastructure a lot because it is a relational concept. I mean, it only exists to the extent it allows something to happen. And thus it's always a link between the past, the present, and the future in some way. And so I think that the space of infrastructure is an interesting one, both conceptually and politically, to be engaged with, because I do think that if we think about disabling the infrastructures of ecocide and genocide and trying to enable alternative infrastructures of mutual thriving, like that's not a bad place, at least from my point of view, it's not a bad place to try to situate yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If I can follow this out just for a second, I mean, energy is relational too, and that makes it no less real. And so I kind of want to pursue that. I do like the way that you kind of come back to superculture at the close and say that kind of sugar hit is the way to think about, you know, fossil culture too, and the sort of endless metabolism made me think about the way that Robin Wall Kimmerer talks about, you know, capitalism as the, sort of linked to, you know, these positive feedback loops in nature on the one hand, but also kind of a Wendigo culture on the other, just driven by this endless appetite for more without an understanding of what the cost is. And she's kind of reading across these different registers to kind of see that pattern. And where I'm going with this might be to drag you back into the argument you're trying to move past, but just towards the concept of energy itself and these sort of debates over its status. So, you know, as you well know, I mean, there's been kind of a running critique now for a while of energy itself as this sort of harmful abstraction that distracts from the material conditions of production of specific fuels and the specific economies they operate within and the territories they're drawn from and the way they're linked to specific histories, like, you know, scholars like Alan McDuffie or Heidi Scott, I think, kind of draw that line of thinking out. But one thing I've always liked about your work in particular is that you keep returning us to energy as a term that allows us to read across these different moments and histories in a way that's productive. And so it's always seemed to me that, you know, what's valuable about energy as a concept is that it can help us see these connections between these different systems and see how they're sort of intertwined or braided together in a wider way. I feel like, you know, energy, I think should be no more or less an abstract, but also a critical concept than the material, right? I think there's this weird sense in which the material is more grounded and more physical and more real, and energy is in some ways out there or sort of ephemeral or ideal or something like that. So I'm just kind of curious after reading this, if you're moving away from energy as a term, or do you really see a place for the term and concept of energy in the energy humanities or public humanities as we look forward?
Yeah, I think I'm stuck with energy, Devin. Thank you for your kind words. I think that I defer when people ask me for like one book to read in energy humanities, I always say Kara Daggett's book, The Birth of Energy, which looks, I think, exactly at this problem of how this sort of Aristotelian concept of kind of potentiality becomes mm-hmm. industrial work, or like a proxy for thinking about work and sort of a foundational concept within physics. And the story she tells, which is so fascinating, and what like a strange cauldron is brewing in like 18th and 19th century United Kingdom, where you've got, you know, Scottish Presbyterianism, you've got coal, you've got new industrial labor disciplines, new senses of time, and a lot of different factors that are flowing together to produce thermodynamic science, let me not forget mm-hmm. that. All of these things are flowing together to give a specificity, a cultural and historical specificity to this conception of energy. And just as you say, I don't want to do away with the concept, because I think it's part of our world in a way that we can't really get rid of it. But I think what we can do is we can do the kind of work that Kara has really helpfully given us guidance with, which is to do really genealogical work. And I'm glad she picked up this concept, energopolitics, which is one that I had been playing around with for a while, as a sort of a riff off Foucault's idea of biopolitics. Okay. But the it's not like a thing. I mean, the thing about the also with Foucault is this concept of pouvoir. Pouvoir is both a noun and a verb in French, as it is in Spanish too. So when you're thinking about like what biopower is, it's not like a thing or phenomenon, but it's this sort of means of enablement. It's like a modal, it's a modal verb, pouvoir. So it's like, you know, what allows you to do something else. And again, kind of on the riff of infrastructure. So this idea of energopolitics, which is definitely something this book is informed by, and attempting to kind of be a little bit more nuanced and detailed with talking about sucropolitics, carbopolitics, petropolitics, and maybe electropolitics, and what those might look like as means of enablement, as things that relations that bring other relations and things into the world. I think the idea of this is we have to just be more specific and nuanced and kind of meta, to use, you know, a trendy word, in terms of thinking about energy. Like, we can't assume that energy is always equal to work, because then we're back kind of really in carbopolitics 101. We're in this idea of industrial labor discipline and machinery and output. And still, that's the energy that I learned. It's the energy that I mm-hmm. learned in high school. Right? Probably you guys did too. But to think about energy back to that sense of potentiality, and where Kara takes her work is, of course, provocatively towards, like, you know, a feminist conception of what energy could be and what kind of feminist potentiality could be. And so I kind of like Deanna's idea of the distributed matriarchal small society. Hey, listen, yeah, we haven't tried that for a while. Maybe it's time to try that again for a while.
I'm joking, not joking.
Yeah, no, I'm there with you. I would sign on to that happily, mm-hmm. personally. Yeah. But I also think that, you know, that thinking about an energy that is liberated from, yes, a masculinism, an industrialism, a relationship to the kind of coal era would be really great. And I wonder what we could do with that. And I don't know that the answer is certainly not in this book or in any one book, but I think that's a collective project we can work on, is imagining what the energies of the future could entail. You know, even in the 19th century, people had crazy, interesting ideas about energy, you know, like electricity yeah. being connected to spirit, spirituality. I mean, there was a lot more than just coal back in those days too. So I want to sort of, you know, think about the abundance of potentialities that could exist in now and in the future.
This is a great segue to my next question. And I don't want my brand to be asking you about the things you didn't put in your book, because that's a very annoying kind of question. But I feel like this one is kind of fair, because I think it's hovering around this book a lot. But to back up a little bit, so when you talk about, you know, and again, one of the wonderful things that I like about this book is the sort of economy of the storytelling, when you tell the sucropolitics, carbopolitics, petropolitics story, and then gesturing toward, and the way you do emphasize that each one builds up and accretes around the previous one. It's not a replacement, but rather an adding on to and developing out of the previous. So, and then of course the question is at the end, like, well, now, you know, question mark, what's next? Electropolitics, but we're not really sure. As you say, the goal, the idea is to have an electropolitics that doesn't build up out of those same you know, structures of petropolitics the way the previous three stories have. But of course, we don't know. It feels like you're gesturing toward the idea of a rupture. Of course, like that's what we all feel, right? That, you know, there's something that is collapsing in a way that's not, so it's not the same story. It's not carbon politics building off of sucro politics, et cetera, but actually perhaps a kind of a dramatic rupture of some kind. And so that brings me to the word that I think appears maybe once in the book, and that is utopia, you know, especially at the end. And I know I actually, when I was looking up your information online, I saw that you taught a class on utopia. I teach on utopia. I write on utopia. We've already invoked Station 11, which is a kind of dystopia. So I was wondering to what extent you would characterize your thinking, especially at the end and the latter sections of the book, as a kind of utopian thinking. And maybe, and again, a kind of related question, are you avoiding that word? Because I know, I know many people who now have, you know, said that they're avoiding the word because it has too much baggage and it kind of it distracts from, you know, from what they're actually trying to get across. It kind of scares people off. And a very slight side question is, I'm wondering if you've read the book Half Earth Socialism by So I'm kind of thinking of their work too, where they are just like going full on in utopia. Let's bring back Morris, for God's sake. I love that book. So I'm actually kind of wondering how you would situate your work with regard to utopia, if that's a term you find useful, and if not, why not? And were there any kind of deliberate decisions that went into that, using it or not?
Not only do I read and teach Troy and Drew's book, but there's a game. Great. There's a game associated with it too, which is awesome.
Yeah,
and I use that in class too. And I sort of give students a challenge to solve it, and they really get into it. And I think again, like the harnessing the ludic dimension of our engagement with climate struggle is so important that I think that's such a brilliant project. And I teach a whole class on revolutions and utopias, and the premise of that class is these are two terms that have a lot of baggage, but are still worth taking seriously today. And so we start, you know, with Thomas More, and we look at utopias throughout time, all the way through, you know, through to kind of the idea of the cybernetic utopia of Allende's Chile, and and the kind of feminist ecological more than human utopias that people are dreaming about today that are so important, I think. So no, I love utopia. And I guess maybe it's one of these things where if you're so deep into utopia, you feel like you don't even, can't even say the word anymore because you're so deep down. And that's my muck. You know, I'm so in that sludge of utopia that I can't even like get my nose out from under it.
Yeah.
But no, I think I make in other work, but especially in my teaching, I really talk a lot about utopias because I think it's important to take seriously that we're living in someone's utopia right now, but it's also dystopia for a lot of other people. Any political project is about creating utopia for someone and often dystopia for other people. So if you frame things, if you frame reality that way, we're living in a kind of utopian scheme of one kind or another. The idea of being able to create alternative utopian or to nurture utopian relations, even ideas from the past. You know, the 19th century was chock full with utopian experiments. I love that people used to just go and set up towns. Of course, they were doing it on indigenous land without permission in many cases. So there was a, if you will, like a fraught side to that too. But this idea of forming intentional communities, of trying to work out experiments, I think that one of the things I wonder about today is in fact whether we've exhausted to some extent that ideology of progress that people really believed in the 19th century, that through technology, through social science, we were going to be able to perfect our social relationships. I think 50 years of neoliberalism and sort of a very, very one-dimensional idea of human nature, which again is the idea of some guys of a certain age with certain kind of complexion idea of human nature, that model is really, I think, depleted our imaginative reserves a little bit. And so part of what we can do as teachers is to really encourage students to do, and I want to do a shout out here to a project that came out out of the University of Osaka, and it's a great project called the Fragmentary Institute of Comparative Timelines, and you can look that up online. Mm-hmm. And they have a website where they put out these thought experiments that you can then teach with. And one of the thought experiments is, what if the bubonic plague had not killed half of Europe, but killed like 90% of Europe in the 14th century? What would the world look like today? A world without a wounded Europe, thirsty for technology and, you know, living large and colonizing the world. Like, what if that hadn't happened? What would the world look like today? And students love this assignment. They love to think with the idea of, you know, kind of what, you know, various kind of Wakanda scenarios across the world of sort of advanced techno-political non-European societies. They love thinking about the ways they could have been new relationships between Polynesian and Amerindian peoples that could have formed. And I love it because, you know, again, as we think about the future, and we have to kind of build up, I think, and limber up our imaginations for what might be possible. These projects are kind of memories of the future, I like to call them. They're little glimpses of the future that, if we harness the speculative potential of the humanities, but also the arts, you know, the arts have a lot to offer here too, that we can actually begin to sort of build these utopias and explore what it is we want. You know, what mm-hmm. do we think it is that we actually want to rally around? And I think, you know, that Edward Bellamy book, which was, I think, mm-hmm. the second most best-selling book of the 19th century. Imagine mm-hmm. that. Imagine
after Uncle Tom's Cabin, I think.
Yeah. Exactly. So imagine a book that is about a guy waking up in a future Boston and mm-hmm. discovering socialism. That book sold like equivalent to like Harry Potter Plus today. I mean, that's amazing when you think mm-hmm. about it. And I'd love to think about what are the utopias that could get people that excited today. I don't know. I'm not sure that any of us have the answer to that, but I think that the project of utopia is definitely not exhausted by any means. So I'm glad you're teaching it and thinking with it.
Yeah.
We should swap syllabi probably.
Oh, absolutely. I would love that. And thank you for pointing out that website. That sounds like an amazing resource. I'm super excited to think about using that. I also just really quickly want to say, invoking Bellamy, of course, you know, as Victorianists, Devin and I are like, you know, 19th century specialists. I'm always thinking about utopia in terms of that foundational argument, if you will, between Bellamy and Morris, and how, you know, thinking, as you said earlier, thinking about utopia is also smuggling in a kind of, you know, old-fashioned, or not even old-fashioned, continuing progressivism or kind of fantasy about infinite progress, that mm-hmm. utopia can actually be subject to that kind of thinking as well, easily enough. And that, in a way, that's mm-hmm. I think that's why Troy and Drew's book about, you know, focusing on Morris and the sort of, you know, backward looking, although that's Bellamy's title, but you know what I mean, the more medieval anti-techno utopia is an interesting distinction there. So thank you for bringing that up. But yeah, anyway, we can really get in the weeds here about you about utopia.
These are great weeds.
Yeah,
this is a great weedy patch.
Yeah, exactly. we're in the muck and the ooze, right?
Got it.
Well, utopias can get pretty messy, I think. That's what you're pointing to. It's like mm-hmm. they have this kind of totalitarian impulse to them. And they make you confront the limits of that kind of thinking too, which is an extremely productive way of imagining. By the way, never identified as a Victorian.
Oh, I'm sorry. I always forget. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Sorry.
But
yeah. Like, you subsume Victorianism. You contain multitudes. You are greater than the Victorian period.
More than Victorian, I think we could go.
Yeah, I got off of got out of the no place. But I think like this also just points to the everything that this book generates in terms of thinking about the decompositional politics, kind of pulling things apart and examining the parts of it. The kind of fragmentary, the necessity of not having a singular rule in terms of building these sort of coalitional politics in the future. And we don't have a lot of time left. I'm just wondering, in the spirit of experiments and imaginings, Dominic, if you have anything you're working on right now or something else you want to point to in terms of a reading list or something to stimulate the imagination.
Oh, there's so many things. And we've invoked a few of them. I mean, I like to give people works in and around energy that really inspire me. And I mentioned Kara's work. And we have this Petrocultures event coming up in Los Angeles where, you know, 300 or so energy humanists are going to gather, hopefully more, and talk about things. I think it's a really exciting moment. And my own work, I think it moves on parallel things. Actually, we have some Simony and I have some projects related to glaciers. We do work sort of on glacier memorials in our spare time. And we've got some projects going on in Iceland this summer. We've just been asked to join a UNESCO task force to work on getting the word out that 2025 is the International Year of Glaciers Preservation. So I'm very happy to say that on this podcast. There will be a number of events coming along about glaciers, and also a lot of field work I've been doing in Houston focusing on community-led alternatives to technopolitics of climate resilience, basically trying to build a different mode of climate resilience from the ground up. As a field worker, as an anthropologist, I think I do think a lot about my work in terms of networks of collaboration. And so, you know, energy still, I think, is something that fascinates me endlessly. I haven't given up hunting fossils either. But, you know, I find that there's also good to balance, you know, some of the projects of resilience and working on other aspects of climate change against the issues of energy transition. So I don't know. I feel like there's like, it's like my mind is like an airport sometimes. There's just like stuff coming and going all the time, and I don't really know what's going on all the time. But it's been really wonderful to work with you, Devin, and on that project of kind of bringing petrocultures to the United States for the first time, where, of course, LA, you know, ultimate petriculture city in a lot of ways. I mean, the city that made petriculture sexy, let's put it that way. Is going to be a great project. Yeah. No, not Houston. Houston made it functional, right?
And Houston made it functional, and LA made it pretty.
Exactly.
It's funny. Exactly. I grew up in Houston, as you know, and I didn't even apply to Rice. I feel like if you and Simony had already been there doing some of the work you're doing, and if I found out about it, I might not have ever gotten out. So
I'm glad you got out, and I'm glad you're inviting us to come to LA, because that seems like a better reciprocity.
Perhaps. Anything from you, Dee, to wrap up?
Nope. Just want to say how much I enjoyed this conversation. Maybe we can, I don't know if we can have access to the show notes, but maybe we could put some of the titles that we've been talking about. I also want to give a really quick shout out. I meant to ask you about Barbara Leckie's book, came out last year, called Climate Change Interrupted, where she talks, it's about climate anxiety. It's a literary, scholarly book, but I think it has a lot of broader interest in there. And some of the things that we were talking about chimed with some of the stuff in her book as well. I think you might, and the people listening might find that interesting too. So maybe we'll make a list of texts for people to follow up on in the show.
Yeah,
notes.
It's a great idea.
Yeah. I can send you some of the links to things. And there's also another book. I can't remember all the editors, but it's called Anxiety Culture. And it's like, so I think we're living in an anxious moment. Surprise, surprise. Right. Yeah. And as three people who've all sort of wrestled with their own panic issues, I think, you know, we're in a good position to help people through it. I think so too.
Yeah. You came for the energy discussion. You're staying for the panic attack advice.
I got to tell you, even as freaked out as I get about climate, I feel so much calmer now than I used to.
Yeah.
And I think it's why it's important to actually do the work of energy humanities and climate action, is it just does make you feel better to be with people who care about these issues. And so even if you're just doing a little something, I think it's so much better than just like doom scrolling the news and sort of feeling really hopeless. There's something anyone who's listening to this podcast can do that is not going to be beyond your capacities to do something really helpful. Yeah. So, and there's a game in the book too. So if you get the game in the book,
I found the last pages of that, of your book, very, very soothing. I don't want to make it sound like quietist, but inspiring, helpful. Yeah, absolutely. So thank you. Thanks for writing
it. And thank you for inviting me in for this conversation. It was amazing. And looking forward to hearing it.
Great.
This was wonderful. All right. Well, bye y'all. Take care. Bye. Everybody out there, be safe. And we'll see you soon.
All right. Take care.